what does it feel like in your body when you're safe? What does it feel like when you're safe in your career? What does it feel like when it's safe to express your voice or your feelings?
Hi, everyone, and welcome to I'll Go First. Today is really special. Amani Mova joins us. She is a psychotherapist and an executive coach and business coach. And this conversation was really around figuring out your identity. And I think it really applies to any of us who are sort of in a time of transition. Right now, Black Lives Matter is really on the topic. We just had COVID. So I think a lot of people are asking themselves, who am I? What do I want? And where do we go from here? So Amani and I talk about decoupling our identity from cultural norms and also how to build safety for yourself. So I'm really excited for you to hear it. Let's get started. Well, Amani, thank you for joining us.
Yes, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So Amani Mova, she is a psychotherapist and an executive and business coach. You have a lot of specialties, which I think are pretty unique. And we have another special guest today who's making his first appearance on the show.
Hey, everyone. I'm Peter Liu.
Peter. So Peter has been a part of our production team the last few episodes behind the scenes. And so today we are having him join us at the table.
I am so excited for this. I'm so excited.
I'm super excited too. I wanted to kick it off because what I find so interesting about your story is really your focus on the immigrant experience. You were not always in mental health.
No, I wasn't. It's kind of something that over time, working with different populations and doing different types of work, I've kind of just started finding patterns and finding different voices and different faces, but similar stories. And working with first-generation students, especially in the university capacity, really helped me understand that it's a common thread, like really like what happens in that journey when people kind of come over here for the American dream. What's really lost over the ocean, so to speak, and what that process looks like on the other end, especially when they find out that dream doesn't exist, and what that duality looks like, balancing the old world and the new world, and the stories that are lost or the stories that they just don't have time to make it. And often they come out in trauma and they come out when they have to, and really exploring what it looks like, how to tell those stories with beauty and with empowerment, not because we have to, but because it's time to.
Oh my gosh, I feel like that was just like a book in and of itself. That's so good. Wow, there's so much wisdom there. I know that you did kind of follow the typical, pseudo-typical journey in going to school for law and then going into corporate.
And that's the stereotypical Indian Asian in me. I think it's just about, well, culturally, there's a high emphasis on education. But also, I think that there's an emphasis on certain occupations, especially in certain cultures and communities. And I think in Indian culture, being a doctor or an engineer happens, or successful in business usually tends to kind of be what's celebrated or mandated. I don't know if lawyer really even cuts it, but I kind of stayed in the umbrella. And I was like double major, triple minor.
Triple minor?
Well, I majored in what I had to, and then I minored in what I liked to. So in acting and writing and things like that. So I was on my way to law school.
I know this just because we had a chance to talk, but you were also student council.
Well, I was student body president and sorority president, things like that.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. I was kind of in that gap between college and law school, and I decided to just take this job where I was essentially representing youth at risk against prosecutors helping the judge make a decision on really what that plan would be.
How old were you at this point?
I just graduated.
So you were 22. This big responsibility.
It was. And it was also humbling because it really brought me into certain areas of America that in one way, it's not that I hadn't seen poverty coming from a developing country, but it was the bright lights, you know, when the lights go out in Atlantic City and the casinos, you know, and then you go in during the daytime and you see what's really there and what's not there. And so really understanding these stories from my law school letter saying, like, I want to go to law school because I want to change the world and make a difference, you know. And so through that role and through that experience, I really understood, like, okay, I'm already doing what I'm saying I want to go to law school for. So why am I going to law school? And I think that was a good moment to really reflect that it was more of that conditioning that you have to kind of get the piece of paper or you have to get letters after your name and you have to do those kind of things to really feel like you're being validated or taken or have credibility, not just in society, but by your family members or your like community, right? So I think it, one, helped me understand the power of a conversation between one human being and another to really sit there with a youth and understand like how that is so real. They ended up in that chair with those decisions mm-hmm. and this predicament in because of such a systematic way. And so how can I represent just a statement representing one person's actions when there were so many hands in the pot? And really understanding and working with youth at that stage, understanding when people really want to make more of their lives, how powerful compassion and forgiveness is, to really go into that space and talk to another person with non-judgment and to say, like, that's okay, we're here now. And then to see the changes they're willing to make or can make was, you know, it was transformational for me.
I think what's so special about your story is that you are such a voice on deconstructing and decoupling identity from, like you mentioned, the American dream. And one of your quotes that I love was that American dream is synonymous with being white.
I think that nowadays there's a lot of conversation, right? There's a lot of awareness, and technology has helped that process. But I think that for certain generations, that wasn't the case. Mm-hmm. A few decades ago, I think there was a different process that happened, which was you just had to become American enough. But American at that time meant being white, because it's usually like this: if you were Chinese in Idaho, you might have been the only Chinese person, or maybe even the only Jewish person in this Midwestern town. Or for me, I was like the only Indian person in many of the places I've lived.
Did you know that you weren't white?
Absolutely.
I didn't realize that I wasn't white.
Sure.
Until I got to New York and I met other Indian mm-hmm. people. Did you know that you weren't white?
I think there were a lot of times when I was like, I could be white. And then I come home and I'm like, nope, that's not true.
Right. I think it was in school too, where I would just, and this is something you talk a lot about too, about assimilating. Mm-hmm. But I just didn't realize there was anything different until suddenly they pointed it out. Like, oh, where are you from? And then also checking off on the papers that you give for standardized sure. tests and the sure. race one. And I remember raising my hand and asking the teacher, like, I don't see – it was like only black or white. And I'm like, right. I don't see myself. Right. Should I just fill in both of them? Like, and she was like, just fill in the white one. And that was a moment where I was like, oh, wait. I don't think I can fill this one out. That one doesn't apply to me.
Right. That's really interesting you say that, because it was like the opposite for me. Because I think as I got older, I started to be like, I'm white, right? Because I'm assimilated, you know? And not literally thinking that, right? Like,
right,
not
totally.
Consciously thinking it
yeah,
at
absolutely
all,
same.
Right? But like subconsciously just being like, yeah, we don't really like see those things anymore, right? Mm-hmm. And I think I've had unique opportunities to be the Indian person in white groups and the Indian person in black groups. And I think that And welcomed.
And
like,
welcomed.
Yeah,
welcomed. That was my next question, if you felt like a token or not.
Yeah, I think that it was kind of like to hear white people talk about black people, but then, you know, to me, gave me that message that there must have been some kind of fusion happening there that they didn't recognize, and vice versa, equally embraced and welcomed and championed in the black community.
I've always felt like the outsider. I never felt like I was welcomed in any community, but I also mm-hmm. grew up in the South.
Sure.
I was adopted by white people.
Yeah.
There were no like middle brown or Asian people around me. It was all white people.
Right.
And then our town is very segregated.
Mm-hmm.
Stereotypical, the black communities on the other side of the tracks and everything. So,
right.
I mean, you both grew up in New York, right?
Yeah. I grew up in New York, and I don't think until I was in my 20s how much code switching I like unconsciously learned to do and never really associated with race in a very like noticeable way.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until like I was in my late 20s where I was like, I speak differently depending on who I see.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
Yeah. Was there a moment that you realized that about yourself?
Well, I'm from Brooklyn and I don't have a Brooklyn accent because I went to school in Manhattan and like
That's the Manhattan accent?
This isn't a Manhattan accent. This is just a weird
Manhattan accent.
Like kid who grew up in Brooklyn and then went to Manhattan. And,
no,
like,
you have a very refined sort of way of talking.
Are you trying to say it's a white way of talking?
Oh my gosh, I hope not. I need to think about this.
That's funny.
Because I ended up going to high school with a lot more white people mm-hmm. than I used to, and it changed the way that I spoke.
Sure.
So
when I was younger, I grew up around a lot of racism. So for me, those messages were very deeply rooted in, they were just like going to be things that I'm going to have to be cognizant of for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And I think that when I did have kind of a little bit of a home in the black community in that way, in the segregated part of town, and going to the black church and really just like being in the culture and later joining a historically black sorority. And for a while, it was kind of like, so it was kind of like that lady that was, you know, the head of the NAACP, and she wasn't black, and they were like, mm-hmm. how is she? And I was like, am I her? Like, do I not know I'm not black? Because I remember getting this event invite that was for black professionals, and I was all like getting ready to go. <You know? laughs> I had this moment where I was like, wait, I'm like, because in college it was okay, because in college it's that segregation, and I think Greek life sometimes creates that type of environment where you're welcomed and embraced in that way, especially in Greek organizations. But after college, it was those moments I had to start kind of taking a step back and being like, okay, I'm not black. Like, not that I like fundamentally thought I was black, but like I can't.
Was that sad for you?
I think that I did have a grieving process because I was a guest in so many cultures and so many places that I had to admit that I couldn't have them as my identities anymore, and I didn't have my own either because I had lost mine so long ago. And actually, it wasn't until I was an adult that I really started meeting Indian people, and I was just like, Indian people! Mm. And then it was like 3 days later, I was like, no more. This is drama. Like, this is the same stuff repackaged, you know what I mean? But I think that also came at a time when I took a really scary trip back to India because my grandfather's last wish was to see me, and I'm estranged from my immediate family. So to kind of navigate that and go see my grandfather and not make the same mistake when my grandmother passed away, I was so scared of that trip and to go there as an American. And I remember I even like dyed my hair black to make sure like I fit in, and then I landed there and everyone was all modern with their highlights, and I'm like, I look like I came off the farm. I'm like, okay, I'm so out of touch. But I just remember like that experience of like landing and getting out of the airplane, and it was just like, I couldn't really tell the difference where my skin and the air like separated. It was just like I had come home and breathed the air and was part of the elements, and I didn't even realize I had missed it until I got there, and I was like, this is what was taken away. I would never do anything in my life any other way, but I think it was one of those moments where it was a deep sadness, but it was a deep joy because I finally started to recognize what it looks like to go into a store and have everything look like you, that you just don't even realize, or like just everyone in general, you don't have to assimilate. I had done it my entire life that I didn't even know what it would be like to not assimilate. That was a really powerful experience because when I came back, of course, I was like listening to Indian music, eating Indian food.
And
I was doing all that for like a little bit. Then I woke up one day and listened to Jay-Z, and I was like, all right, I'm back.
Yeah, I think I felt definitely I related to the Black community as a kid. And I did a TED Talk in 2012, a really long time ago. And that was before I found my biological family in India. And it was also before I found out that my grandparents who raised me, who like technically adopted me, I didn't find out until 4 years later that they actually weren't related to me and that I was half Moroccan and half Indian. So prior to that, I was like, well, I can get a pass because I'm half white. Yeah. But then after that, it was like, oh my God, I'm fully brown. And then what does that mean? But it's been really a grieving process for me because I feel like I missed out and all this stuff.
Absolutely.
And then when I found my Indian family in London, they were so welcoming. Sure. But definitely when I see pictures of them, I'm like, man, I didn't get to have this established relationship with
them.
And really, I say I'm adopted, but really like my father just didn't want to be a part of my life. So I had to hunt him down for many years to be like, I want to be Indian and I just want to know you.
Right.
But when I did the TED Talk, oh my gosh, y'all, I say in the TED Talk that I thought when I was a kid that I was Black. And then when racial Durst Law came online and was getting exposed for being a part of the NCAA, I was like, oh my gosh, I think that like this is on, this lives forever on the internet. And sure enough, somebody commented and they were like, well, I'm not mad at her for her shoes, but she's at least not Rachel. And I could see how she could be confused. But just seeing that comment, I know you're not supposed to look at the comments, but just seeing that. Right. And now with Black Lives Matter, I'm just like, I wish I could take the video down.
Well, I think like that's where I think compassion for forgiveness is important in our culture right now, because I think that as we're evolving and educating and creating awareness in this way, we're not leaving any room for people to just have any error. And we can't move forward as a society if we're like, you're not perfect and you haven't always been perfect. And I think that's a really missed opportunity. And it's counterintuitive for any level of consciousness that we're trying to reach, because those moments matter. That moment you're sharing right now, that's the human experience. And I know sometimes we don't always have the perfect sentence. And I know earlier I said, joking obviously, like, oh, I didn't know I wasn't Black, but that's not what I meant. What I meant is a group of people had taken me in and given me a home and a sense of place of belonging that I didn't have to question, that when I did have to question, it was a deep loss. And I had to ask myself, then where is home? Because this is no longer mine. And I think that we have to be careful as healers or change makers that we don't hold each other so tightly to times when we had less awareness. What's the point then?
This is such a good way to say it. I just realized all three of us at the table are, one, we're people of color, but also we're all artists. And there was definitely a moment in my life where I had to make the decision to become an artist and not to become like this narrative, the letters behind my name that I thought I needed as an Indian person and become an actress instead. And I'm wondering, you know, you've just recently pivoted into the arts. I'm blowing up your spot, Peter. So Pete, I'm just going to say it because I think I have to push you a little bit.
Okay.
But Peter is now doing stand-up comedy.
Nice, nice.
Yeah, and that's not technology.
It isn't. Yeah, when you talked about your experience getting all of these degrees and all of these minors and following this very traditional Indian path, it's not too dissimilar from how my dad raised me as an immigrant, as a Chinese American. My entire life was groomed for me to become a lawyer, and it's very clear that I did not do that. So I'm curious as to what that experience was like when you were talking about you understanding that you wanted to become a lawyer to change the world and realizing for yourself that you've been doing it.
I want to be a congresswoman at the time, just to be clear.
I mean, there are a lot of people from entertainment that are in politics, so the dream is not lost, people.
There's one big one.
There's a big one right now.
This is true. As an NYU alumni, it makes me kind of think of like Aziz Ansari, like where he actually like went to both Stern and Tisch, doing the proper thing and then also doing like the, you know, like the artistic thing. And I find that very common in certain cultures, especially Asian, where it's kind of like you create spaces to do both. There's no luxury of pursuing one with all your heart. And so it's nice to see, back to the generational thing, that now more second generation youth are able to do that. Some of that stigma is gone. When you're talking about, like, speaking of Aziz, when you're talking about being in the Midwest and not knowing that you were any different, it's like Parks and Rec joke when Aziz is like, I'm from South Carolina and I'm what you would call a hick. I always find that funny because I think being artistic in general is like, I always say I was born with a pen, but when you have something to say and you have something to show the world, I don't think it really matters what occupation you really have. You're either going to do it like Patch Adams, or you're going to take whatever you're doing and you're going to execute it in your way. That it's even for people, like, if they feel a little restricted in what they have to do, or like they're at the point in their lives where they might have, like, you know, they have a family and they're like in this type of career. Well, art isn't just painting a picture or like writing a poem. It's about how do you make your work poetic? How do you make it expressive? How do you make it liberating? How do you make it healing in your own way? And you can do that no matter where you are and who you are. It's just the approach you take it. And I see that all the time. It takes courage.
You had mentioned before that you work with a lot of high achieving people. Mm-hmm. And when we talk about the American dream coming over and sure. It being not what they expected. Right. And I really want to know, because I've been struggling with this in my own life, about reaching those milestones. Sure. And then being like, oh, because my milestone was really finding my biological family and mm-hmm. meeting these Indian people. And everything was built around that. Going mm-hmm. to acting school was so I could be on TV and maybe I had a better chance of finding them or them finding me. Right, and then my human rights work was because I went to India to search for them and then found out about human rights. And that's where that path mm-hmm. diverted. And now I'm like, I guess I'll just go back to school to feel purposeful.
Yeah.
I'm just actually, this is a question for you both. Yeah. You know, what happens when you, because you're in that phase right now where you're sort of taking a different turn in your career.
Yeah, I feel pretty similar to your experience because I, before podcasting and stand-up comedy, I had started a tech company to kind of achieve what I perceived as this American dream. And that was me trying to win the pride of my father and my family to be that kind of success. Mm-hmm. And then I got burnt out and I didn't love what I was doing. And I realized that I could be proud of what I'm doing outside of that context. And so now I'm on this journey as well.
That's great. That's great, because I think every time someone does that, they send a message to someone else who is in a similar situation, that there can be a wave of that. And so every person who does something like that, it matters. You're part of the process of changing that shifting away from that very toxic traditional way. Because a lot of what we're talking about is the fear that has come from the immigrant experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Most of the time it's because people just want the best for their children and they have a sense of which occupations are going to help them be financially stable and secure after they're gone. And so they encourage their children to go focus on those things because it's from a survival point. I'm sure that if that wasn't in place, they'd be like, oh, go dance in the streets and, you know, do whatever you want, you know. But they didn't feel like they had that luxury, and they saw their parents not have that luxury, and they saw all the sacrifices that had to be made for them to come to continue that process. And it's like a passing down of sacrifice. And so it's just natural for them to say, you're going to have to sacrifice that, because they did and then everyone before them did, right? Mm-hmm. And much greater things. So I think that every time someone does that and goes after their passion, we build a fabric of security in that process, that you are safe, right? Like, it sends that message, like, it's a safe thing to do this. Like, it's okay, we're all right, like, we're here.
Did either of you, because I think I got kind of lucky. I mean, I grew up in a really abusive household, but I got lucky, I guess, in the sense that I have the reverse happening right now, where I don't have the guilt of not going into that career early on, but now I feel pressure that I'm putting on myself to have those letters behind my name.
Right.
And so I'm struggling with kind of some guilt and shame, and I'm wondering if either of you have ever struggled with the guilt of or shame of leaving the community?
I think guilt is huge and shame is huge too. Even when you find people who look like you, I think that it's just there. It's in the room. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, for a lot of different reasons, sometimes people don't like that you have choices when they don't. So there's not necessarily going to be a camaraderie around that. And that's something to be aware of, which I didn't realize. But I think I mentioned this before. I think it's a psychological thing. Just because you leave your environment or the people who have given you these messages doesn't mean that you haven't inherited that, one, on a cellular or ancestral level.
Yeah,
and
that's
two,
real.
And two, that you, if you were brought up saying, like, you have to be a doctor, or you have to do this, or you have to do that, yeah, you can go. Like, you can leave that house and that room and that town and then go. But that doesn't mean that that pressure and that voice is gone. And that's the part we have to heal, yeah, is say, no, so I am, it's okay. Like, I don't need to do that. But I think that that's a tricky thing. And for me, for a long time, like, I had left my biological, I left that space that I received a lot of those messages, but for many years I was still collecting. It was like, it just
How did you find that strength to leave? Because you had mentioned earlier about, you know, even for both of you, deciding to leave the stereotypical careers that like are culturally ingrained, there is that moment that somewhere inside of you was that tipping point. I have this quote from you because I thought it was just so brilliant from our pre-interview. Life belongs to you and you can define that. You don't need to be defined by culture or systems. You are whole just the way you are.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that. I think I was way wiser when I was a child. Sometimes I like take out these poems I wrote and I'm like, oh, it was an oracle, you know? And now I'm like, can't even send a tweet out. I was in a unique situation as a child, and I had immigrant parents who weren't the healthiest, and I had a brother who had epilepsy, and so a huge part of my life was kind of protecting myself and also protecting him, and also being bullied at school for not being white. And it created an immediate complexity because I had to manage all these different hats and different compassion and strength, that kind of thing. And I read a lot, and I wasn't really, you know, I didn't really wasn't really around other people. I just went to school and I came home, and so I was pretty isolated. So I would read about like Anne Frank, and I was a real light reader, you know, like, and about slavery and about a lot of oppression that I didn't learn in school. I think that it was like my window to the world, because I knew that even though I was isolated in this one way, that so many people had come before me and are out there now and will be there in this world when I go back, when I go out into this world.
I think when I hear you talk, I'm not hearing a lot of safety at all as a part of your narrative. And just thinking through about having a blank slate to try and figure out identity. So I'm hearing you're not really rooted in the identity until you got off the plane in India. And even that's kind of complex.
Right.
And then building safety, because that wasn't a part of your experience as a kid. So how have you made space for all of that? How have you built that security for yourself now?
Definitely has taken years to understand what safety means. I find with my clients as a psychotherapist, the one thing that I really do make sure that is fundamental for every single client is safety. So I drill that into them, like safety. Safety in your relationship, safety in your mind, safety with your emotions, safety in the room.
How do you do that?
Yeah. I think because I know so well what it means to not be safe, and the compromises I've had to make because of things I was deprived of and not knowing how much power I had given away growing up for fundamental things like love.
I feel like you got them taken away. I don't even feel like as a kid.
Yeah.
I don't think we even have agency over that. I feel like you got it taken away. You didn't even have the option to give it away.
Yeah. Luckily, I was raised by my grandparents for a small amount of time. So I had a foundation when I was like very in those developmental years. And I'm so grateful for that. That was a defining factor for me, being different and being able to cope differently. But then when I came to America, it was like meeting two strangers, meeting my parents. And it was heartbreaking because I saw them being discriminated against and their suffering, and then also wanting to be loved by them and accepted by them, and the gap there. So safety is something that I think that is an ongoing process for everyone. I think that we can't rest in that. We can't just say like, oh, I found the love of my life and now I'm safe. It's something we constantly reassess. And that's by knowing, that's by creating self-awareness to really know, like, what does it feel like in your body when you're safe? What does it feel like when you're safe in your career? What does it feel like when it's safe to express your voice or your feelings? So when you really build an awareness around that, then it doesn't matter who walks into your life or who leaves, because you'll know if that was safe or not. It won't be contingent on these labels that people often give, right? Like, you're my good friend and you're my safe friend, you're my toxic friend, and you're my, and that kind of thing, right? So it's the other way around. It's like you really understand who you are at a core level, what's acceptable for you, what's not. And then everyone else has to meet that criteria. And I encourage my clients often to not create different criteria for people. It shouldn't be different for someone who is your boss to treat you a certain way, a friend to treat you a certain way, and your mother to treat you a certain way. Respect is respect. Boundaries are boundaries. And people often do that. They're like, oh, no, that's my mother. And I'm like, yeah, that's cool. That's your mother. Sometimes we don't have the choice to not have someone in our lives if that's your boss or a family member. We do have choice in really being honest with ourselves of the impact of how much having this person in your life or how much interaction with this person is costing you. And then from that, making decisions on how to set boundaries or how to spend more time with these people and less answer the phone, less on the send with this person or whatever that looks like.
What do you think comes first, identity or safety?
I don't know if I would order them, but I think that your identity definitely can be defined by your level of safety. Maya Angelou comes to mind when I kind of say that, I love her, but I remember reading her poetry and having a sense of her identity in one way for so long as a child, and then finding out she was, you know, a prostitute, and I was like, what? And I think that that's kind of an example. There was a time in her life where she had to make certain choices that defined that aspect of her identity that depended on her level of security or safety. But when she became more secure and safe, especially in her belief in her core system, she became so expansive that she's someone that will be remembered long after she's gone. And so I think identity, to answer that question, is very connected to safety, but I don't know if we can separate them as one or the other.
As we sort of close, what is something that you want us to know?
Yeah. I would love to say, like, if anyone is exploring these concepts that we're talking about, like identity and safety and pursuing your dream or the immigrant experience, race and context and how many different ways we have our story and then we have our story of our story. And I think that I would just say that this is just the beginning. So if there's a desire or there's something inside of you that wants to really do something transformational in your life that goes against all the messaging you've received or all the experiences you've had, even the things you've been your own witness to, well, that's all you need is that desire. Like, now is the time, and you can do whatever you want. You really can. There are consequences and choices in life, but you never have to resign.
Wow. Wow, I wish we had more time. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Britt. This is great. Thank you. Yeah.
I'm Jessica Minhas, and thanks for joining us on I'll Go First. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Our mission is to uplift and support you in your journey of healing. If you like what you heard, please subscribe, comment, and share. And if there's a topic you'd like us to dive deeper into or would like to share your story with us, we are available on all major platforms at I'll Go First and www.illgofirst.com. We'll see you next time.